Part 15, Chapter 2. Johnny had been in a coma for 3 days. They had brought him to the ancient underground military base in the Rocky Mountains, where salt filters could be dropped into place at once if a counterattack materialized from the planet Cyclo. The hospital complex was very extensive. It was all white tile, hardly any of it cracked. The Russians had cleaned it all up, and the parson had buried the crumbling dead. 15 of the wounded Scots were there, including Thor and Glencannon. They were in a separate series of rooms from Johnny's, but one could hear them now and then, especially when the pipe major gave them an afternoon concert. Dr. Allen and Dr. McKendrick had already discharged 5 of them as reasonably well and certainly too restless and impatient to keep idle when so many things were going on elsewhere. Chrissy had been in constant attendance at Johnny's bedside, and she rose when Dr. McKendrick and Angus McTavish came in. They seemed angry with one another, and Chrissy hoped they would go soon. McKendrick put a hand on Johnny's forehead and stood there for a moment, looking at the ashen pallor. Then he turned to Angus with an expressive hand that seemed to say, "See?" Johnny's breathing was shallow. 3 days before, Johnny had awakened and whispered to her to send for somebody. There was always a Scot guard at the door, his assault rifle blocking out would-be visitors, of which there were too many. Chrissy had brought him in and watched worriedly while Johnny whispered a long message to Robert the Fox. And the guard got it on a picto-recorder mic held close to Johnny's lips. The message had been to the effect that if another gas drone appeared in the sky, they could probably stop it by landing 30 recon drones on it with magnetic skids and racing their engines on reverse coordinates so the gas drone's motors would burn out. Chrissy didn't understand the message, but she did understand that it was too tiring to Johnny. He had relapsed back into a coma, and when the guard came back to say Sir Robert sent his thanks and would do that, Chrissy was quite cross with him. The same guard was on again when Dr. McKendrick and Angus were let in, and Chrissy vowed she would reason with him. McKendrick, yes. Angus, definitely no. McKendrick and Angus went out, and the guard closed the door behind them.
"Look,"
said McKendrick, dragging Angus into one side room after another.
"Machines, machines, machines. This was once a very well-appointed and outfitted hospital. Those big things over there, I have seen them in an ancient book, were called X-ray machines. It was a subject called radiology."
"Radiation?"
said Angus.
"No, man. Not on Johnny. Radiation is for killing cyclos. You're daft!"
"Those machines let you look inside the body and find out what is wrong. They were invaluable."
"Those machines,"
said Angus angrily,
"were run by electricity. Why do you think we light this place with mine lamps?"
"You must get them running."
"Even if I did, I see by that one they have tubes. The gas in those tubes is over 1,000 years old. We can't get any more of it and couldn't get it into the tubes if we had any. You're daft, man."
McKendrick glared at him.
"There is something pressing on his brain. I can't just go plunging into it with a scalpel. I can't guess. Not with Johnny McTyler. People would slaughter me."
"You want to see inside his head? Well, why didn't you say so?"
Angus went off muttering about electricity. He told a standby pilot at the heliport that he needed to get to the compound fast. The pilots were very few, and they were being run ragged. They were zipping off to all parts of the world. They had a sort of international airline going that was beginning to visit every remaining pocket of men on the planet at least once a week. They were ferrying World Federation coordinators and chiefs and tribal leaders as fast as they could. More pilots were in training, but right now they only had 30, plus the 2 in hospital. So a casual request, even from a Scot, even from a member of the original combat force, was not likely to get much heed. travel from the underground base to the compound was usually by ground car. Angus told him it had to do with Johnny, and the pilot said why hadn't he said so, and pushed him into a plane and said he would wait for him to come back. With grim purpose, Angus went to the compound section where they kept the captive cyclos. A small area of the old dormitory level had been rigged to circulate breathe gas, and unreconstructed cyclos were there, under heavy guard. They numbered about 60 now, for occasional ones were brought here from distant mine sites when they surrendered peacefully. Turl was captive elsewhere. Angus got an air mask, and the Scott guard let him in. The place was very dim, and the huge cyclos sat around in attitudes of despair. One didn't walk in the place without being covered by the guard. The prisoners expected a cyclo counterattack and were not too cooperative. The Scott engineer located Kerr and dug him out of his apathy. He demanded of Kerr to tell him whether he knew of any mining equipment that would let one look through solid objects. Kerr shrugged. Angus told him who it was for, and Kerr sat there for a while, his amber eyes thoughtful. Then, suddenly, he wanted to be reassured as to who this was for, and Angus told him it was for Johnny. Kerr was turning a tiny gold band around in his claws. Suddenly he sprang up and demanded that Angus give him an escort and a breathe mask. Kerr went down to the shops, and in a storeroom there, dug up a strange machine. He explained it was used to analyze the internal structure of mineral samples and to find crystalline cracks inside metals. He showed Angus how to work it. You put the emanation tube under the object to be examined, and you read the results on the top screen. There was also a trace paper reader that showed metals in alloys or rocks. It worked on some wavelength he called subproton field emanation, and this was intensified by the lower tube, and the influence went through the sample and you read it on the top screen. Being cyclo, it was quite massive, and Kerr carried it for him to the waiting plane. A guard took Kerr back, and Angus returned to the military base. They tried it with some cats they had that were cleaning the rat population out, and the cats afterward seemed cheerful enough. The screen showed the skull outline very nicely. They tried it on one of the wounded Scots who volunteered, and they found a piece of stone in his hand from a mine injury, and he too seemed fine afterward. About 4 o'clock that afternoon, they used it on Johnny. By 4:30, they had a three-dimensional picture and the trace paper. A very relieved Dr. McKendrick pointed it out to Angus.
A piece of metal. See it? A sliver just below one of the trephine holes. Well, we'll just get him ready, and I can have that out with a scalpel soon enough.
Metal? Scalpel? On Johnny? No, you don't. Don't you dare touch him. I'll be right back.
With the metal trace paper flying behind him, Angus, 15 minutes later, charged in on the Chamco brothers. They worked in a separate breathe gas dome at the compound, industriously trying to assist Robert the Fox to put things back together. Angus shoved the trace under their pug nose bones.
What metal is this?
The Chamcos examined the trace squiggles.
Ferrous damonite,
they said.
A very strong support alloy.
Is it magnetic?
Demanded Angus. And they said yes, of course it was. By 6 o'clock, Angus was back in the hospital. He had a heavy electrocoil he had just made. It had hand grips on it. Angus showed McKendrick how to guide it, and McKendrick worked out the best path to bring the sliver out with the least damage to tissue. A few minutes later, they had the broad sliver in their hands, withdrawn by the magnet. Later, the Chamco brothers identified it with closer analysis as a piece of a battle plane skid strut. which has to be very strong and very light. Johnny had not been conscious enough to tell anyone what he had done on the drone, and Chrissy had shooed off the historian when he tried to find out earlier. So it was a bit of a mystery as to how a sliver piece of a strut could have been daggered into Johnny's head. But whatever they had done to him, Chrissy was extremely relieved. The fever he had dropped. His breathing improved, and his color got better. The following morning, he came out of the coma and smiled a little at Chrissy and McKendrick and dropped into a natural sleep. Planetary radio was not slow in crackling with the news. Their Johnny was out of danger. The pipe major paraded his pipes and drums all around the compound on the heels of the crier who was yelling it out to work parties. Bonfires blazed both there and in various other parts of the world. And a coordinator in the Andes relayed the news that the chiefs of some peoples they had found there had declared this an annual celebration day, and could they come now and pay homage? A pilot standing by with a plane in the mountains of the moon in Africa had to get help from both coordinators and chiefs of that small colony in order to get space to take off again, so mobbed had the field become with celebrating, jubilant people. The compound radio operators had to double up on shifts to handle the message traffic roaring in on them as a result of the announcement. Robert the Fox just went around grinning at everybody.